Hello. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Tom Lane with Sabbath Bible Study. Is the Bible relevant in today's world? The Bible was written thousands of years ago, and in this modern era, is the Bible still relevant? Today, during the sermon, we'll take a look at that question. And to begin, we'll start by looking at Hebrews chapter 4, beginning with verse 11. Hebrews 4, verse 11. Let us labor, therefore, to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. When people are questioning the relevancy of the Bible in today's world, they have unbelief. Verse 12, for the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. That's what's valuable about the Bible, that it can help us understand our heart. We've looked recently at the concept that as people we can only judge unrighteously because we look at judging through our five senses. The Bible helps us understand the intents of the heart. Verse 13, neither is there any creature that is not manifest in the sight, but all things are naked and opened unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Jesus Christ is our high priest today as he was at the time of his death. And we have incredible mercy available to us in the modern era. Even though times have changed, technologies have changed, people sometimes wonder if God and Jesus Christ have changed. Let's look at Hebrews 13, verse 7. Hebrews 13, verse 7. Remember them which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and forever. Be not carried about with diverse and strange doctrines, for it is a good thing that the heart be established with grace, not with meats, which have not profited them that have occupied therein. We have an altar whereof they that have no right to eat which serve the tabernacle. So the altar that we have in our Christian faith is a different altar than the altar of the Jewish faith. Verse 11, for the bodies of those beasts whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned without the camp. Wherefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered without the gate. Let us go forth therefore unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach. For here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. We are seeking that new Jerusalem, which we learned about during the Feast of Tabernacles. So we know from verse 8 that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus Christ does not change. Does God change? Let's take a look at Malachi 3. Malachi 3, verse 6. We looked at Malachi last week. We'll review these two verses today. Malachi 3, verse 6. For I am the Lord, I change not. Therefore, ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. Even from the days of your fathers, ye are gone from mine ordinances, but have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. But ye said, wherein shall we return? So we know the Lord does not change. The Lord will allow us to return to him, and in that situation, he will return to us. We know that we live a Christian faith in a modern era. one that questions the relevancy of God, one that looks at the convenience of technology over the miracles that come through faith. Is the Bible relevant? Let's look at the Bible through the eyes of prophecy to see if it's relevant. Let's look at the Bible through history by looking at archaeological proofs. We'll also look at scientific evidence confirming the validity of the Bible. And we'll take a look at some examples of wisdom that are given to us in the Bible. As I'm recording the sermon today, there are huge wildfires raging in California, both in the southern part of the state in and around the Los Angeles area, as well as the northern part of the state, just north of the San Francisco area. Television reporters interviewing people caught up in the fire are sharing reports that those people saw the fire coming down from heaven. Whether or not that's happening all over the place, we wouldn't know. But it reminds me of a passage from the book of Revelation. We'll take a look at the book of Revelation, chapter 8, verse 1. In this particular section of Revelation, we're talking about the first trumpet of the seven trumpets. I don't think that the California wildfires are part of the seven trumpet plagues, but it gives us an example of what will be coming in the very near future. Revelation chapter 8, verse 1. And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. There was a huge moment of silence because of what was going to happen. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it into the earth, and there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. And verse 7, the first angel sounded, and there followed hell and fire mingled with blood. And they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. And what do we see happening in the southern and northern California areas? We see trees being burnt up, and when these trees catch fire, these huge firestorms develop around the trees. Imagine what this planet would be like if every third tree was burning up. There would be smoke billowing from the bottom of the ground almost all the way up until the upper reaches of the atmosphere. Clouds would begin to darken the sky, and the sun would not shine through just so that the sunlight could see the earth. These are only the very beginning of the bad things to happen to us. When we see these fires springing up around the world, they're only a small sign of what's to come. What's to come is based on our obedience to God. All we need to do is take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 28. That's a book in the Old Testament that talks about blessings and cursings. There are good things that happen to us when we obey God, the blessings. There are bad things that happen to us, the cursings, when we disobey God. It's interesting to take a look at Deuteronomy 28, and that's something that I would encourage you to do separate and aside from the sermon today. But take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 28 to see the blessings that we have in our life for obedience and the cursings that we have for disobedience. You'll see that the blessings and cursings from thousands of years ago are blessings and cursings that we see today. Blessings and cursings do not change for disobedience to God. The Bible is a timeless book. Beyond the prophecies that show what will happen in the future is this rich history around the world. And history as we know it is brought up in archaeological sites. Different things are found in the different archaeological sites. For instance, there was found a crucifixion victim, a person who had been crucified about the time of Jesus Christ, maybe about a century beforehand. There had been debate at some point whether people who were crucified were simply allowed to basically rot away on the cross. But what this particular archaeological dig found out was that people who were crucified were allowed to be buried and given burials consistent with the time period of the day in which they lived. Another bit of archaeological history is a decree that came from Claudius, who determined that anybody who raided a burial site, a sepulcher, or moved the sealing stone could be guilty of capital punishment. They could receive the death penalty. Many people look at that kind of a decree as one that is in response to what happened with the resurrection of Jesus Christ. A little more than 30 years ago, back in the mid-1980s, Israel suffered a massive drought, and it caused the waters of the Sea of Galilee to recede. The Sea of Galilee was where Jesus was on a fishing boat with his disciples. And the people noticed a fishing boat exposed in the mud, and great efforts were taken to preserve that particular boat. And the design of the vessel was determined to be typical of fishing boats used during that time. It measured over 27 feet in length and could easily hold about 15 people. So you look at Jesus Christ, the disciples, that boat would be big enough to handle all of them. The archaeological information that we have available to us shows that time and time again, the written accounts of the Bible can be confirmed through the archaeological record. So the Bible is not simply a book of fantasy. It's a book of reality, and when it comes to the history of the Bible, what was recorded of happening thousands of years ago, the archaeological record confirms what we see. When we look at the Bible, we sometimes think of the Bible and science as being distinct and separate. Really, they work very well together. There are some scientific proofs which also show the validity of the Bible. In the book of Psalms, we'll look at Psalm 102, the 102nd Psalm, beginning with verse 25. Psalm 102, verse 25. Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of thy hands. They shall perish, but thou shalt endure, yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment, as a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. So here we have compared the eternity and unchangeable nature of God compared to the universe, the heavens of old, which will change over time. A big distinction between the two. And what we have from this verse is a confirmation of the second law of thermodynamics. And the second law of thermodynamics confirms the validity of what we read in Psalm 102, verses 25 and 26. Today, we understand the universe is always changing. But when Psalm 102, verses 25 and 26 were written, that was not the viewpoint. People thought the universe was solid and did not change. They thought it stayed the same. Today we understand things like light years, that it can take years for light to travel from one part of the universe to another, and that when we look up into the universe and see the stars at night, that really what we're looking at are is the light from thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. And what we see up there in the night sky today reflects what existed thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, and it may not be exactly the same today. But that was not what people believed when the scripture was written down. People believed the universe was not changeable. What Psalm 102 verses 25 and 26 showed was that the universe would degrade over time. That's very much a modern concept, that the universe degrades over time. There are many different ways how this second law of thermodynamics could be considered. Isaac Asimov stated it one way in the Smithsonian Institute during June 1970. He said another way of stating the second law then is the universe is constantly getting more disorderly. That's what Isaac Asimov said, that the universe is constantly getting more disorderly. In other words, the universe is degrading. As people age, our bodies become more disorderly. We have less control over our body and more things are likely to happen. It is only when we are in the prime of our life that we have the best control over our physical bodies. But as the universe ages, it constantly gets more disorderly. People who are scientifically minded, who question the validity of the Bible, will often look to the account in the book of Genesis for the creation of the earth. And many people who read the book of Genesis will look at a six-day, 6,000-year history of mankind. And they'll ask the question, what about the dinosaurs? And that's a great question because we have lots and lots of dinosaur bones in museums. There are movies made about the dinosaurs, Jurassic Park, the series being probably the most famous of all the movies. So does the existence of the dinosaur bones discredit the Bible and make the Bible an irrelevant book? And the answer for those who are careful to observe what's written in the Bible would be no. And I'm going to give you the reason why. Let's take a look at the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis 1, beginning with verse 1. Genesis 1, verse 1, it says, "In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." And that's the very first knowledge that we have of the heaven and the earth and God, that this took place in the very beginning. Most people move on to verse 2 immediately without any consideration to any difference in time. When we take a look at verse 2, we get some words and phrases which, for those who study the Bible, should give us caution. Let's take a look at verse 2. "And the earth was without form and void." The Hebrew words tohu and bohu. And what we need to know from that is that those are phrases which indicate confusion. In the biblical record in verse 2, we have the earth in a confused state. And we see that God was moving on the face of the waters as the earth was in this confused state. Most people will look at verse 1 and 2 happening almost simultaneously. 1, 2, almost that very quickly. That's not what the scriptures would indicate. When we take a look at 1 Corinthians 14, verse 33, from the Apostle Paul, we are told that God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all churches of the saints. So if God is not the author of confusion, he could not be the author of the confusion that took place on earth in Genesis 1, verse 2. The two would be inconsistent with each other. Most people who study the Bible, who accept the fossil record of the dinosaurs, would believe that there were millions of years that took place between Genesis 1, verse 1, and Genesis 1, verse 2. That what happened in between was this huge satanic rebellion, and that caused the earth to become without form and void, as Satan would be the author of confusion. So we know that God and Jesus Christ are the same yesterday, today, and forever. We know that there are archaeological proofs which verify the accounts of the Bible. We know that there are scientific collaborations between what is recorded in the Bible and scientific laws that exist. There are other proofs we can use to show the validity of the Bible as a modern and relevant book. There's wisdom that we can gain from the Bible that is timeless, that was as practical when it was written thousands of years ago as it is today. One of the best examples of wisdom that we have in the Bible is how King Solomon handled what today would be called a child custody dispute. Let's take a look at 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 16. 1 Kings 3, verse 16. Then came there two women that were harlots unto the king and stood before him. The fact that the women were harlots, lower class women of questionable reputations, in many legal situations could get them immediately discounted. Solomon did not allow that to weigh into his decision. Verse 17, and the one woman said, O my Lord, I and this woman dwell in one house, and I was delivered of a child with her in the house. So these two women who were disputing custody of the child lived in the same house. They were roommates to share the cost. Verse 18, and it came to pass the third day after that I was delivered, that this woman was delivered also. So both women were pregnant and gave birth at about the same time. And we, continuing in verse 18, were together. There was no stranger with us in the house save we two in the house. So it was only these two women living in the house with their babies. No other people lived in the house at the time. Verse 19, and this woman's child died in the night because she overlaid it. So one of the women had their child die because the child was sleeping in the same bed as the woman, and she basically laid on top of the child and suffocated it, the baby. Today, we're always told that babies should sleep in a separate bed away from parents so that parents do not roll over and lay on top of and suffocate a child. Verse 20, and she arose at midnight and took my son from beside me while thine handmaid slept and laid it in her bosom and laid her dead child in my bosom. So from this story, we'll understand that both of the babies were baby boys. Verse 21, and when I rose in the morning to give my child suck, behold, it was dead. But when I had considered it in the morning, behold, it was not my son which I did bear. So this mother was able to see that the dead baby was not her son. And verse 22, and the other woman said, nay, but the living is my son, and the dead is thy son. So immediately there was a dispute between the two women, whose son was whose son. And this said, no, but the dead is thy son, and the living is my son. Thus they spake before the king. So they came before King Solomon with a child custody dispute. Both claimed that this child was theirs, and that the child that had died was the child of the other mother. A very complex decision to be made at a time thousands and thousands of years ago before there was such a thing as DNA. In the modern era, we would simply use a DNA test to determine whose child was whose child. But back thousands of years ago, there was not that luxury. So verse 23, then said the king, "The one saith, this is my son that liveth, and thy son is the dead, and the other saith, nay, but thy son is the dead, and my son is the living." And the king said, "Bring me a sword." And they brought a sword before the king, and the king said, "Divide the living child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other." King Solomon was going to have the baby divided in two. Sounds brutal to us today. I don't really think King Solomon would have had the baby divided, but that's how he presented the information to the mothers. As king, he could have had the baby rightfully divided in two. Verse 26, "Then spake the woman, whose the living child was unto the king. For her bowels yearned upon her son, and she said, O my Lord, give her the living child, and in no ways slay it. But the other said, Let it be neither mine nor thine, but divided." So here we had two mothers responding to this determination made by the king. The mother who actually gave birth to the child was willing to let the child live and to let the other mother have the child. The mother whose child who had died, who was pretending to be the mother of the child that was alive, was willing to have that child split in two. A big tell in whose child is whose child, because parents don't want harm to come to their children. Verse 27, "Then the king answered and said, Give her the living child, and in no wise slay it. She is the mother thereof. And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had judged, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to do judgment." So King Solomon used wisdom to settle a child custody dispute. He recognized that there was no stronger love for a child than the love of a mother for her child, and that mothers would be willing to sacrifice greatly for the benefit of their child. We see that happen in many different ways in the modern era. Child custody debates are part of our modern era, and the Bible continues to be relevant. 30-some years ago in the state of Florida, there was the case of two girls who were switched at birth. And the fact that they were switched at birth was not discovered until one of the girls had died, and it had come back to the parents of the girl who had died that there was no biological way how that girl could have been their daughter. After some research and review and the early use of DNA tests, they were able to determine that their daughter was switched at birth, and that the girl who died was, in fact, not their daughter. You would think that a story like that might have a happy ending, but it caused a lot of emotional baggage for the girl who survived. And she, you know, by some news accounts and news interviews that she'd recently given, you know, recounts the story of having a really rough part to her adult life with that. The biggest point of relevance looking at this example from King Solomon is simply child custody decisions that stem from a divorce of the child's parents. When a family is dissolved and a decision needs to be made, what's going to happen to the children it's important that the families take a look at what's going to be in the best interests of the child. And sometimes families, the divorcing spouses, have different opinions about what's going to be in the best interests of that child. And those become some of the messiest, dirtiest family court decisions that have to be made. I always think it's best in those circumstances for parents to honestly take a look at what's going to be best in the interests of the individual child. In the modern era, we have principles that we live in. One of them is separation of church and state. Probably practiced less than it is preached. I think religion continues to have a significant influence over the politics of countries. Let's take a look at an example that Jesus gave us in the New Testament. We'll take a look at Mark chapter 12, beginning with verse 13. Mark chapter 12, beginning with verse 13. In Mark 12, verse 13 is the big debate on taxes. Is it legal for people who are religiously minded in the faith to pay taxes? And the Pharisees and the Herodians used this as an attempt to entrap Jesus. On the one hand, they were trying to get him to blaspheme our relationship with God. On the other hand, they were trying to get him to trip up and put himself in criminal jeopardy with the civil authorities. The Bible is a book of wisdom that we can use in many different ways to help us answer and navigate the trickier situations that we face in the modern era, using the words of Jesus to help us. Let's look at Mark 12, beginning with verse 13. And they send unto him certain of the Pharisees and of the Herodians to catch him in his words. They were trying to entrap him. They were trying to get him to say things that would cause him a lot of personal grief. This happens all the time in the modern era. When people ask a politician a question, many times the words and phrases are designed in such a way to lead to a certain answer. Politicians have become skilled in navigating those very difficult kind of situations, and when politicians lack the skill, they find themselves in a lot of continuous hot water with the news reporters and members of the public. Verse 14, and when they were come, they say unto him, Master, we know thou art true and carest for no man, for thou regardest not the person of men, but teachest the way of God in truth. So a very good way to open up a conversation and to entrap somebody is to lower their guard. The best way to lower somebody's guard is to give them a very high compliment. There was nothing that these folks said to Jesus in verse 14 that was untrue. They said, we know thou art true. Jesus wasn't a liar. They knew Jesus wasn't a liar. They acknowledged that. And carest for no man. Jesus was not a respecter of persons. He didn't value one person over another person because there was any political or philosophical merit. Jesus solely regarded people based on the teachings of the Bible without regard to the individual person. They knew, continuing in verse 14, that he taught the way of God and truth. They knew that he did not err in his teachings of what was in the Bible. And then they asked the hard question, is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar or not? Can you pay taxes to Caesar? And they asked him this question because they were hoping to trap him between his allegiance and truth to God and the legal responsibility to the civil authorities. Verse 15, shall we give or shall we not give? And then Jesus thinking, but he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, why tempt ye me? Bring me a penny that I may see it. So right away, Jesus knew that the Pharisees and the Herodians were not being legitimate with their question of him. Jesus knew that these people were trying to trap him through words, that they were trying to tempt him. And so he simply asked, bring me a penny that I may see it. And so the penny is a coin that is issued by the government. And verse 16, and they brought it. And he saith unto them, whose is this image and superscription? So whose picture is on the coin, and whose name is under the picture? And they said unto him, Caesar's. So the Roman coins had the image of Caesar. And Jesus answered them in verse 17 and said unto them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. In today's modern era, we face many different issues that are not too dissimilar from verse 17. Today, we often find ourselves caught up in discussions on politics and financial systems. The terms liberal and conservative are used frequently in political discussions. Capitalism, socialism, communism are used in discussing financial systems. And we're often asked, you know, what would Jesus do? Jesus would not be caught up in politics. There's no record of him in the Bible being caught up in the political system of his day, and there was a political system that was present when Jesus was alive here on earth. We have a reference here in the book of Mark about his view on the financial system, that the financial system is definitely something that is controlled by the government. We should not find ourselves as Christians being caught up in the political and financial system debates that we see in the modern era. Everything that is not of God is evil, and politics and the financial systems that we know are evil, even though we live in the country where we have a political system, we live in a country that uses a particular financial system, it is evil. We live in societies that are not living or advocating a lifestyle that would be found in the Bible. The principles from the book, though, of Mark 12 can be used to address all of these. For instance, in the political system, we recognize that it is evil and we shouldn't be caught up in it. But there's nothing wrong with us in acknowledging the power and greatness of God while respecting the nation's political system. If there is an expectation to vote, then that is something that we should not have a problem with as a Christian. In a financial system, Jesus was specifically asked about paying taxes. Should we pay taxes to Caesar? A big hot button issue of the day. Well, that's something we should have no problem with today. When we look at the societal ills, probably one of the big ones that people have a lot of debate about in the religious sector is gay marriage. Homosexuality is something that is not viewed favorably in the Bible. There's no way that somebody could read the Bible and come up with a different conclusion than that. When it comes to gay marriage, what should our viewpoint be? I think a lot of the problem with the viewpoint of gay marriage is just the term marriage, which is used both religiously and civilly. That's where a lot of the problem comes from. If society, from a civil viewpoint, recognizes gay marriage, then purely from a civil standpoint, that is something that even though we may religiously disagree with it, we should civilly respect. There's a difference between the civil recognition and acceptance of gay marriage and the religious acceptance of gay marriage. When I take a look at the Bible and read the Bible, I don't see where there is any provision that would allow for gay marriage. So from a religious standpoint, that's something that I simply could not accept. As a person living in a society that accepts, from a civil viewpoint, gay marriage, that is something from a civil standpoint that I could accept. There is a difference between the two. And I think when we come to the very challenging issues that face us in today's world, we do need to use the wisdom of Jesus Christ, just as Jesus Christ answered the question on rendering to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. The Bible as a tool is a tool that is used to condemn people. There are many Christians who will use the Bible as a tool to condemn people who are gay or homosexual. We will be better suited, instead of trying to condemn somebody else, when it comes to religious terms, to look at our own salvation and to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. Notice Revelation 22, verse 7. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. Verse 8. But the fearful and unbelieving, the abominable, murderers, whoremongers, sorcerers, and idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Everybody has problems and sins in their life. And when Revelation 22, verse 8, says that all liars can end up in the lake of fire, that means we are all very greatly at risk of not being part of this wonderful world tomorrow. There are many people who can find fault with other people, but it's not going to be you or me. Just because somebody is homosexual is not a reason why we should have a reason to find fault with them. That's one of the teachings we need to take with us from the Bible. Let's take a look at how Jesus responded when he was confronted with somebody who, according to the law at the time, should have been stoned to death. Let's look at John chapter 8, verse 1. John chapter 8, verse 1. Here's an account of a woman who was caught in the act of adultery. And at the time, that was a punishment for which she could have been put to death. Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives, and early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them. Jesus had his morning routine. He went into the Mount of Olives, and then he came to the temple to teach. And people wanted to learn from Jesus. He was the new, if you will, rabbi who had the attention of a lot of people. And the scribes and the Pharisees brought unto him a woman taken in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said unto him, Master, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. This is a woman who was caught having sex with a man, and her punishment could have been death. They reminded him in verse 5, Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned, but what sayest thou? So they didn't remind Jesus of this to check on his great and infinite wisdom. They were trying once again to entrap Jesus. They were trying to get him to either to deny the law of Moses or to validate that this woman should be stoned to death, and disenfranchise him from the people who had found inspiration in the teachings of Jesus. They were trying to put Jesus in a very bad spot. And instead of answering the question, instead of falling into the trap, Jesus did something different. Notice verse 6. This they said, tempting him, that they might have to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground as though he heard them not. So Jesus pretended not to hear them. You don't always have to answer every question you are asked. Sometimes you have to respond in a way that will make the most sense for you and your circumstances. In verse 7, so when they continued asking him, Jesus, what should we do? He lifted up himself and said unto them, he that is without sin among you, let him cast a stone at her. A decent answer to give. And again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last, and Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. We do not know from this passage what Jesus wrote on the ground. There are many who think that Jesus wrote down the names of the men with the women, possibly dates. Who knows what Jesus wrote down? We don't have a record of that. But we know the men left because of their conscience. Whatever Jesus was writing reminded them of something that they had done bad themselves. And in the very end, it was Jesus left alone and the woman was standing with him. And Jesus looked up and saw none but the woman, and he said unto her, woman, where are those thine accusers? Hath no man condemned thee? And the woman correctly answered in verse 11, no man, Lord. And Jesus said unto her, neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more. So we started today's sermon by asking a question, is the Bible relevant today? We know that Jesus and God the Father are the same yesterday, today, and forever. That does not change. We know that the Bible is relevant because prophecies that look to the future really reflect things that are happening today, such as fires and wildfires burning out of control. We know that throughout the modern era, there have been many findings of archaeological proof that validate stories that are written in the Bible. We also know that there are various scientific proofs that validate what is in the Bible. And we also know that when people clearly understand the Bible, that they can understand that the Bible is a valid book, yet can account for the fossil record of the dinosaurs. We know that the Bible is a modern and practical book today because the wisdom of the Bible is a timeless wisdom that transcends time. One of the best examples of wisdom in the Bible was a child custody dispute claim that came before King Solomon. Child custody debates are debates that we see day in and day out in the modern era. We say concerns today over paying taxes. And should we pay taxes to an unjust government? And we have guidance given to us from Jesus. We take a look at the trickier situations that we have in the modern era, such as gay marriage. And we have wisdom given to us how to answer that particular situation, knowing that we should delineate between what is religious and what is civil. We know that we should not judge others because of what we would view as sins, because we know that we have all lied and we are in danger of the lake of fire, and that it is only mercy that will save each and every one of us. And finally, we take a look at how Jesus responded when a woman was accused of a sin for which she could have been put to death. Jesus did not take a look at those accusations at face value, but rather confronted the accusers. And as the accusers left, there were no more accusers left to accuse the woman, and Jesus declined to accuse the woman. Jesus is not the accuser of the brethren. That's the role of Satan. So what did we learn today? We learned that the Bible is a modern and relevant book. It's a book that we can use to guide us as we make decisions day in and day out. And we know that there's nothing in the modern or scientific record which would dispute what we would find in the Bible. God has given us an incredible opportunity at eternal life and salvation. It's one we know we cannot take lightly. And gladly, He's also given us His Word in the written form, the Bible, which is a modern and relevant book that we can use as a tool through daily study and meditation and reflection to get to that future time of happiness in this kingdom of God. And we know that the Bible is useful for all things in helping us get to that future goal of salvation. Thank you for joining us today. God willing, we'll get together again next week on the Sabbath. Until next time, thank you for joining us today.